So in setting the motivation this morning, as we look across the world, and we see the state of other living beings who share this planet with us, there's a number of ways that the mind can go. If it's somewhat being self-preoccupied with the happiness of just this life, we could actually have a sense of relief that it's them and not us. And at times, because of the sorrow of the world, that's understandable, that thought. At other times, we just get angry, feeling hopeless and helpless. But the beauty about this particular spiritual practice is that we can open our hearts through practice to studying the teachings and becoming friends and very, very aware about the workings of our own minds, to see that we have extraordinary potential to cultivate all of our good qualities limitlessly. To be able to eventually eliminate that thought that says, I'm glad it's them, not me, completely. And to open our hearts and our minds at some point that we can look at the suffering of the world and not give up hope. To know that we are inextricably connected and dependent upon all living beings, that they are part of our living family, human or non-human. And that our spiritual practice has an effect. Not just that it'll make our minds calmer, kinder, gentler, more compassionate, but to the Dharma very much tries to show us that because we are such a dependent existing planet, that what we do within our own minds and hearts really makes a difference. And it starts with one, and then two, and then three. Every being that we touch, it is like throwing a beautiful stone into a pond. And that we deal with the disturbing afflictions one at a time, from the coarsest to the most difficult, down to the more subtle. We nourish and make sure that the good qualities we have don't decline, and we really get inspired to grow the ones we don't have yet. So after a while, the virtuous qualities come to the forefront. The not-so-helpful qualities take a back seat. And over time, much time, through constant practice, consistency, honesty, and compassion for ourselves, we can really bring these minds and hearts of ours to a capacity to be able to not only see the suffering of the world, but to become awakened quickly in order to be able to help and guide all those who do suffer as well. And so today's sharing is all about cultivating that kind of mind and heart that can really lead others to awakening, to be able to cultivate our own mind to an awakened state for their benefit. One step at a time, moment by moment, little by little, to be content to create the causes for that to happen, because it surely will if we stay on track cultivating these qualities within ourselves. So may we do that today in our sharing for the benefit of all beings. Once again, good morning, everybody. It's lovely to see all of you. I know it gets kind of crazy this time of year. You weren't sure. Sometimes the weather means they're all coming or nobody's coming. So thank you for coming. So I'm going to kind of go into a little bit, quite a bit more detail of a verse that we are now on in this wonderful book that Venerable Thupten Chodron, our abbess, wrote, coming up on 2 years now, because I think the copyright's 212. That is a commentary on 37 verses that were written by a remarkable, he's considered to be a bodhisattva in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, those remarkable beings who practice the Buddhist teaching so enthusiastically, so consistently, so determinedly, that they progress very quickly along the path, cultivating all of these good qualities that we're all aspiring to develop, eliminating all the ones that don't serve anybody anymore. And bodhisattvas want to become awakened as quickly as possible so they can be in the most perfect position and know exactly how to take care and guide all sentient beings. So it's a lovely idea to think that Tongmei Sangpo, who wrote the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas, has been recognized as one of these bodhisattvas, that we have them living in our world. I find that extraordinarily encouraging, because he kind of started out kind of like an ordinary person, just like the rest of us, totally overwhelmed by his disturbing emotions and having no idea on how to find happiness and its causes. But through practicing the Buddhist teachings, he became a realized the nature of reality and became a bodhisattva. And out of his great compassion, he wrote these 37 verses on how to train as a bodhisattva. And in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they are called lojong teachings, or mind training teachings. And what they do is they give us circumstances that all of us run into in the course of a day. And instead of going to the default, which is one of the afflictive states of mind, is that bodhisattvas train on how to look at these things differently, to actually utilize them in order to be able to cultivate the good qualities we have, rather than falling into the habit of ignorance, anger, and attachment. So these bodhisattvas, like Tongmei Sangpo, through their great kindness and compassion, wanting to benefit, wrote these verses. And Venerables, Don't Believe Everything You Think is a commentary on these verses that she has thought about and contemplated and meditated all of her monastic life. And so she has, and she's brought it kind of up to the beauty about, you know, the Dharma, is that even though he lived in, 1300s, what he wrote about and what he's sharing is just as crucial right now as it was then. So Venerable, one of her gifts is taking these commentaries and these teachings and bringing them up into modern times so we can really resonate with them. So Don't Believe Everything You Think, which is probably the pith instruction for mind training, is that, we've got to start questioning how our minds think. And the subject of attachment that we're going to be sharing, that Venerable Tarpa led us that meditation on, it's one of the states of mind that we've got to start doubting the way that we're thinking, because attachment is a sneaky devil. So we're going to try to do a little bit of exploring on it. And what's interesting is that Venerable subtitled this verse, The Misery of Attachment. She didn't say the unpleasantness. She didn't say the slight discomfort of attachment. She's calling it what it is, which is the misery of attachment. She's trying to have us look at this in a slightly different way, because attachment is not one of those afflictive states of mind that's easy to track, because it feels so good when you first get the hit. So she wants us to look at this and kind of look at our minds a little differently. So here's the verse that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of what we're dealing with. Sensual pleasures are like salt water. The more you indulge, the more thirst increases. Abandon at once those things which breed clinging attachment. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. All right, those sensual pleasures, salt water. You kind of know what that tastes like already. And it breeds clinging attachment, these sensual pleasures. So we're going to see what we can do about those sensual pleasures. So the first thing that I wanted to, and I want to make this kind of as the thread to keep our minds in as we go through this today, is that the general universal truth of every living being, irregardless whether it's human, insect, animal, even in other realms, is that the fundamental truth, as Venerable Tarpa stated today, is that we all just want to be happy. We all don't want to suffer. This is a natural entitlement by the sheer fact that we simply exist. And that is the motivating factor on why we get out of bed in the morning, why we do what we do, what we say, why we eat what we eat, what we experience is that we just want to be happy. And we don't want to suffer. And what happens, because unlike bodhisattvas, unless there are some of you hiding in here in the room incognito, is that we're pretty confused about how to do that. We don't know how to find happiness. We don't know how to avoid suffering. And attachment is one of the ways in which this confusion plays itself out. But to remember, as we go through this, you know, because when we start recognizing these afflictive states of mind, sometimes our default as Westerners is that we're going to start beating ourselves up and feeling badly and feeling guilty and what to do, is to remember that underneath this afflictive state of mind is a sentient being who simply wants to have happiness and hasn't quite gotten clear about a lot of the time what the causes of that are, and instead go in the opposite direction and find suffering at the door instead. So first, to kind of get to go off a little bit on Venerable Tarpa's definition this morning, which is very important to get the concise definition of attachment, is that we want to identify to see what it is about it that brings the misery that Venerable mentions here in the subtitle. Okay, so I want to go over the definition. Very important to understand so we can discern attachment from aspiration, from attachment, from care, from interest, from enthusiasm, from joy. It has a very particular definition. It's very helpful to kind of put that in our mind as well. Okay. It is a state of mind, also called a mental factor, that either exaggerates or superimposes, so makes up, construes, good or positive qualities or attributes of a person, an object, an idea, an experience. And from this exaggeration, a strong sense of I want, clinging, craving, wanting to hold on, wanting to garner that object. All right, so as soon as we meet an object and there's a pleasant experience, the mental constructs begin immediately. And that's not for all the objects of the world. Each of us have got our own little objects of attachment that we get to know what they are over time. But the mind goes in and starts embellishing, starts romanticizing, starts exaggerating, starts fantasizing about qualities that are not. If they're in that person, they're exaggerated. And a lot of times in that person object, they're superimposed, they don't even exist. And because we created this object, then we cling on it, and we cling on it as the source of happiness. So here we are with that wonderful, beautiful motivation of wanting to be happy and not suffer. And we've conjured up some sort of object here that we believe from its own side can bring that happiness that we long for. Okay, so that's the definition of attachment. It's exaggerated. It's a mental construct. It's a whole thing about our conceptual mind that takes on a pleasant sensation and just builds a whole little story, a whole little Hollywood studio around that pleasant experience. Now, what ends up sort of complicating the situation is that the mind also sees this desired object as something permanent. You know, if I'm going to have happiness from this object, I'm going to have it forever. It's going to last. It's not going to change. In fact, from that very object, the DNA, the molecular structure of that object, has as one of its components happiness coming from its own side, oozing, tantalizing, cajoling, seducing me. Yes, that's where it is. It's part of the DNA. You know what infatuation is. You know, it is in the DNA of that person. They have got that happiness and that pleasure and my satisfaction all wrapped up in that little string. And what's hard about attachment, that unlike some of the other afflictive states of mind like anger, that when we have it in our minds, it's uncomfortable enough a lot of the time that we actually have some energy to do something about it. You know, because it just makes, I mean, anger, jealousy, depression, they feel uncomfortable. They make us want to do something about them. Attachment's very different. When you first get the first hit of attachment, it's tantalizing. It's exciting. It's anticipatory. it makes the body feel alive. I'm alive. I've found the source of my happiness. I can't believe it. And so it's very, very hard to sort of figure out that this is a distortion. This is an objective experience I'm having because my body's telling me so. Forgetting that the mind has already put the Hollywood set out there. And the other thing that adds even insult to injury is not only does it see only the positive qualities and exaggerates them and sees them as permanent, as being the source of happiness, but it totally dismisses, there's nothing bad about this thing. There's no shortcomings. There's no failures. There's no, it's going to not last. I mean, there's no sense that there's something wrong with this object. Only the good things, only the positive, only the exciting things that we see about this object. All the other not so good stuff, dismiss. It's not even in the purview. It's not even in the framework. It's been totally disregarded. Okay, so we're not seeing reality here, folks. We're not in line with reality. And that's where we think our happiness lies. That's the distortion, the deception of attachment, is that beautiful motivation of wanting to be happy and to be able to create the causes has been hijacked, and it's now being placed on this poor unsuspecting object that's just abiding and ceasing moment by moment. It's going to break, it's going to fall apart, it's going to die, it's going to leave. And here we are just putting this huge expectation of being the source of our happiness on that unsuspecting object. And I kind of had to laugh when we had this, because coming into the holiday season, I got to tell you, if we're going to have attachment, have a cornucopia of objects to be able to hook into, this is definitely the time of year. I mean, we have a whole time of year of holidays. I mean, they kind of, Christmas, New Year's, football season, Valentine's Day, St. Patty's Day, April Fool's, baseball season, Memorial Day, summer vacation, 4th of July, Labor Day, Halloween, back to school. We have a whole season where attachment can have limitless objects to actually, hook us. So holidays are a time when this mental state can really go hog wild, because it gives us a lot of objects, it gives us a lot of situations, it gives us a lot of people that could become objects of our attachment and throw the whole thing out of balance, the whole thing out of whack. So the first paragraph that's here, Venerable says, this verse, the one about salt water, concerns our love affair with sense objects. Okay, so we have a love affair, folks. All right. We are infatuated with sense objects. All the external possessions, people, status, fame, praise, experiences that we crave. Okay, we have a love affair going on here. One of the things that's very important to remember about this, and Venerable Tarpa also said this morning, is that the object in and of itself is not all right? There's nothing wrong with the person. There's nothing wrong with the experience. They're in our lives. They're created. They function. They're with us. They're in relationship to us. It's what our mind thinks about those things that disturbs the relationship to them and makes the relationship with them really sticky and gluey and tight and kind of graspy and clingy. It's our inner dialogue about it, how much we want it, how much pleasure it's going to give us. That upsets the whole apple cart. But the object in and of itself is neutral. So we have to remember that, giving up attachment doesn't mean we have to go up into a cave somewhere, bare naked and sit up there and work with our minds. Because the attachment's still going to be there. There's nothing wrong with the pleasure. And part of the understanding is that from the Buddhist worldview, there are lots of these different realms of experience. And through our karma, we have been reborn in the desire realm. We have five senses. We have eyes and ears and nose and mouth and touch. And we have this mental consciousness. So part of the desire realm is that we've got this sensory experience, the things that come in. This is our whole existence in this realm. We created the karma for it. So we've got to, I mean, it's, in and of itself, it's not a problem. It's just that we've got this mind that keeps forgetting that they're just these little impermanent blips on the screen, and we just put a whole bunch of expectations and a whole bunch of pressure on those things to be the source of happiness that they simply can't be. So we have to remember that we've got this realm that we're living in, we've got these senses, we've got this mind that have a relationship to these objects. I mean, that's part of living in the realm. But it's what we do with that that is the difficulty. And this is where the salt water analogy begins, because due to this misunderstanding that we think those objects are the source of happiness and what they can actually do for us, we automatically, instantaneously, unconsciously ask them to fulfill needs that they simply can't. We want them to fulfill our needs for love, they want them for comfort, security, safety, satisfaction, fulfillment, which they simply can't do. But like salt water, no matter how much we ask, no matter how much we partake, they're not going to be able to do it. Maybe for a little bit. I'm not going to say that attachment doesn't, I mean, part of the hook is that you actually do think that that happiness is coming from that object. Maybe for a few minutes, maybe for a few hours, maybe even for a year or two. You know, it's not like, you know, the attachment crumbles at the first, you know, sensory overload. That attachment can stay in there, and as long as things don't get too, like, we don't get disappointed or something fails on that end out there, that attachment can hang around for a while. But sooner or later, because the very nature of the object itself is that it doesn't last. You know, it's like, what do I want to say? It's like we're setting ourselves up. The objects themselves are impermanent. They arise, they abide, and they cease. They disappear, they go away, they die, they break, they leave. And they're going to fail to live up to our unrealistic expectations. And where the misery increases is that we don't recognize this misconception about where our happiness lies. And so if that one disappoints me, I'm going to go look over there. And I'm going to go look over there. And I'm going to go look over there. Like we haven't connected the dots yet. But we're putting where we think our happiness comes from does not exist. If that thing disappoints us and we get a divorce, I'm going to go over there. Like we haven't connected the dots yet. That it's not the object that failed. It's the mind that's projecting that's doing it. And that's why we keep doing it. Our whole culture, you know, that's the hard part about our Western cultures. Our whole economic system is like driven by this idea that our happiness, yes, go out and get it, go out and buy it, go out and acquire it, go out and live with it. You know, and that's the source of the happiness. Our whole system, our economic system can't maintain itself without attachment running full time in at least, I'd say, half the population. The rest of us are sleeping or taking a break, and then we switch. Okay. Those who are sleeping, even in your dreams, you can still also have attachment. And what's really funny is that, okay, so not only a huge part of our economic system, but also our sense of patriotism. You know, attachment's got to be kicked in if we're going to be patriotic. We've got to acquire, we've got to have, we've got to want, we've got to desire. And encourages this misconception of happiness. You know, if they used to say, or your money back, you know, the system has got us so snookered right now that they don't even say, and if you're not completely satisfied, you can have your money back. It's only going to last for 6 months anyway, so why even bother to put a guarantee on it? So we've built up this whole distortion is driving this culture of economy. They don't even have warranties anymore. Or if they pay $400 for the warranty, you know. But they used to say, or you get your money back. And they don't anymore. I just noticed that was an epiphany when I was reading this chapter. Okay. And the more we are attached to people and things, the more upset and angry we become when we don't get them or they disappear or are destroyed. So this is where we get into the 8 worldly concerns. So we have this huge attachment to stuff, pleasing words, what people think of us, and these limitless sensual objects. And adversely, we don't want to be separated from the stuff. We don't want to have any blame or criticism. We don't want to have people think badly of us. And we don't want to have anything unpleasant coming into these 5 senses. And so all day long, we'll become like emotional yo-yos. We go into happiness, despair, because inevitably, because those things can't make us happy, we're continually disappointed. So we go through this circle. And it goes with the people we love, it goes with the objects that we have, the things that we don't like. I mean, the eight worldly concerns drive so much of our day. In the sincere effort to just be happy and not suffer. That's the tragedy. That's the tragedy about this particular mental state, that it's hijacked this beautiful motivation to just connect. Yeah, those eight worldly concerns. What a pistol. So then I thought that, okay, so all beings want to be happy. We want a healthy, balanced relationship to our world. We do. You know? But this attachment keeps us bound in a very unhealthy one. And it's hard. Because sometimes the things that we are most attached to, we live with. We own. We have very close access to. You know, it's not like attachment. We attach to things that are far away, that don't matter. Some of our greatest attachments are to the people that we care about, the objects that provide sustenance, things that benefit us. It's just that we've got them all misconstrued. We put a lot of pressure and a lot of unrealistic expectations on them. Okay, so abandon at once those things which bring... abandon at once! Mm-hmm. Okay, so what does Venerable say about Tongme Tsongpo's directions here? Abandon at once those things which breed clinging attachment. When they're the nearest and dearest, when they're your grandchildren, when they're your home, when they're your dog, what do? Let's see. Well, you don't have to abandon at once those things. Well, Venerable says here, we need food and shelter. We need clothing. We need medicine. We need friends. We need family. We're social creatures, for goodness sakes. A healthy relationship is what we need. However, sometimes it's very difficult to abandon clinging when we're very near the things to which we are extremely attached, because our mind is not yet trained in other ways of relating to these things. There's a very strong, disciplined, clear mind that is crucial to be able to identify this attachment, to bring it in, to rein it in, to take off the superimposition, to take off the exaggeration, and to just look at that human being, just look at that iPod, just look at that home, just look at that kitty cat for what it is. You know, just this impermanent phenomena that's in our lives. We can enjoy them, we can care about them, we can love them, we can utilize them to benefit ourselves and others. But we've got to, like, bring the whole expectation down. Take the pressure off. Because these things are not responsible for our happiness. They can't. And that's why we get so disappointed, get so pissed off. Because they can't. And we wish that they would, but they don't. So she recommends taking some space and some distance from these things so the attachment doesn't flare up and overwhelm us. That might be difficult when you're living with your attachment. But what I wanted to do to kind of work on this on a kind of a practical level is, how do we abandon them, or how do we change our perspective about them to be able to sort of cut this attachment off at the chase? So what I thought I would do is, the holidays are upon us. Okay, so we're going to start working on this attachment. Some of my favorites, they might be some of yours. And we're going to look at some of the attachments that may arise during the holiday season and some of the ways to look at them. So even though we might not be able to abandon them completely, we might be able to get a little bit of space and a little bit of clarity and a little bit of a reality check as far as how we relate to them. Okay, first one I put in here. And once again, shake your head if they set off something. Attachment to people. All right? Boy, that's... And then the holidays. I mean, all the loved ones come. The new The new romantic interest is coming to the family for the first time. The grandkids are coming. The sister, the brother you haven't seen in 12 years. I mean, the holidays are time to bring people together. And that's the possibility where attachment can arise, because we just love them so much. But what we want to do is look at them really closely. Do we see them as they really are? Do we see them with their good qualities? Do we see them with their bad habits, their limitations? Do we see the whole person? Or are we inventing some figment of our imagination? This is a very helpful thing to do when someone comes in for Christmas that you really love. There's a lot of attachment in there. Is to say, how am I looking at this loved one? How am I looking at this friend? Am I seeing them as just a sentient being who wants to be happy and not suffer? Or do I have a hook in there, some expectation that my happiness comes from them showing up, behaving in a certain way, making me happy, agreeing with me, supporting me, giving me what I want? Well, they live forever. Is there anybody that's going to live forever? And notice how the word my influences how we see them. You take the word my off of anybody in our life and just say friend, brother, grandmother. It can be anybody's. You put my friend, my grandma, my spouse. That little word makes for a lot of misery. So looking kind of, you know, checking out your relationship to these lovely people that you might be attached to and running them through how, you know, living forever and how are we seeing them, and look at the way that my changes our relationship to them. All right, attachment to sense pleasures. Food, drink, shopping, decorating, entertainment. The holiday season. Boy, just amplified the opportunity of these objects. So what we do here is we look at the transitory nature of the object. 5 days to cook it, 40 minutes to eat it. $115 for that tree, and by the time Christmas comes, half the needles are on the carpet. And it's really helpful to see how food and drink, how it arises, ceases, and goes away. And if you're not careful, what the results are. If you have a certain relationship to them, it can cause a lot of misery. Attachment to praise. Ooh, especially from those we're attached to. And that, you know, it's like, what kind of gift? What's the motivation for giving them a gift? If you're attached to praise from somebody, what's the motivation for giving them a gift? How big is it? How much does it cost? It really influences. If you're looking for sweet sounding words from somebody in particular, we're going to, that gift's going to mean something more than just, I care about you and I want to show my affection. So, well, the best thing to realize is that praise is just a bunch of words. They can praise you, go outside and somebody, you know, you run into somebody's car, you're going to get a whole lot of different sets of words than what you heard in the house. That they're just words. And that they change. And that praise has nothing to do with developing our good qualities. If you want to become awakened, praise is not one of the qualities that Buddha's worried about. They don't care about praise. So we have to see on how pleasing words, what do they really do fundamentally in our own minds to sustain us? Sustain us. They're fleeting pleasant experiences, but do they sustain us? And what do they do to our egos too? Okay, so attachment to praise. Attachment to reputation. Are you the traditional family house that the Christmas everybody comes to? Have you been doing it for 15 years? Setting up all the decorations, the food, the music, the ambiance. Because we care about what people think. God, everybody comes into the house, we're all going down to the shelter and we're going to help cook the dinner. What if you turn the whole thing on its head? You know, family traditions are tough. When you're attached to your reputation, they're really hard things to renegotiate. But it's all about what people think. And once again, this is just a thought of somebody else that's going to change. And in the end, whose opinion really matters? You know, what we think of ourselves is really, that's the reputation that we want to really take care of, is how do we perceive ourselves? How do we care for ourselves? How do we love or compassion with ourselves? That's the reputation we want to care for. What other people say is going to change. Somebody's going to, they're going to think well of you there, over there, they're not going to think well of you. Changes moment by moment. And okay, we did sense pleasures, and then the stuff, attachment to stuff. Well, gosh, there's so much stuff. Maybe it's the clothes, maybe it's the food, maybe it's the technology. My goodness. Okay, so once again, is the happiness coming from that iPad? Is it coming from that new big screen? Is it coming from those new boots? Is it coming from that beautiful jewelry? Is it coming from that great music? So we start once again seeing, is it lasting? Is it bringing a happiness that's going to sustain itself? Or is it fleeting? And once again, it's not, enjoying is a good thing. The Buddha said pleasure's fine, enjoyment's fine. But we've got to understand what that means. You know, to bring it down to its realistic relationship to us. Christmas can be an extraordinary, harmonious, wonderful, joyful, fun. We've got to really see it for what it is. It's merely labeled, first of all. There's a day, you know, there's a merely labeled day, and it has a merely labeled spiritual or significance to it. And then there's all these merely labeled people that come together, and they have these gifts. And I mean, there's all this stuff that's just a karmic appearance. And we invest a lot in that label. So we've got to just see it as, you know, to try to have a healthy, balanced relationship to this time of year. And still have fun, still love, still care, still enjoy. And what's very helpful is the advantages of cultivating a kind of non-attachment is that, first of all, our lives will become a little bit simpler because we'll have a little bit of a less compulsion to buy things that we don't really need. Okay, so simplicity is a good thing. Our spiritual practice will stabilize without the distracting influence of attachment. Have you ever wondered when you really want something and you're trying to practice, do meditation? It just doesn't work. They're huge sources of distraction. We begin to see others in a more unbiased way, taking into account all of their qualities and caring for them. And it kind of opens up our hearts to just not the near and dear. But when we see sentient beings as just wanting to be happy and not suffer, there's a real kind of the inclusion of who that refers to gets bigger and bigger. Because to be Buddhist, to become awakened, we've got to love every living being like we love our grandchildren, or we love our cat, or we love our parents. You know, we've got to really see that as something we aspire to. So I wanted to share with you two things, and I'll do the thing in the book. There's a great story that is just a perfect story about attachment and how it plays itself out. And then I'll ask for some comments and some questions, and then if we have time, I have something that I want to share with you, something that I thought would be apropos for the holiday season. Okay, so this was from one of our dear Dharma sisters, and it's a great story. Okay, because at the end of each one of these verses, Venerable asked some of her students to write things that have happened in their lives where they've used this verse to counteract a particular state of mind or a particular difficult situation. Years ago, a friend was in the business of selling authentic artifacts that he had painstakingly found in India. He would go to faraway places such as Rajasthan and spend months combing through collections of objects and furniture that had been taken from villages that were being transformed into concrete housing projects. He had a great sense for what was beautiful and authentic as opposed to the knockoffs. He handpicked unique pieces and shipped them back to Canada. These beautiful items were then offered for purchase, and my partner and I would spend several hundred dollars at each of his sales, filling our house with more and more stunning and fascinating artifacts. I was in love with anything to do with India, so at one time I purchased 3 gowas, not knowing that they were Buddhist prayer containers. I was magnetized by them. They stirred my mind and heart. But the more we acquired, the more we wanted to acquire. Our desire was endless, and what our friend made available was somehow endless as well. We purchased things even when our house was full. Visitors to our home noticed how full it was getting, and they were always astounded at the quality and the beauty of our unique possessions. Just see the attachment. It didn't stop with artifacts. Then it was dinosaur bones. Large dinosaur bones. Petrified wood. Pretty rocks. It was a seemingly endless cycle, and our house seemed like a museum. At some point, I realized this acquisition was out of control, although my partner remained in the cycle. When I began listening to the Dharma teachings, it became clear very quickly that happiness would not be found in possessions. And so my purchasing days began to slow down and eventually ceased. As my understanding of the teachings grew, I began to see how my approach to accumulating possessions, even unusual artifacts that were unlike anything my friends had. This was difficult for, you can see how difficult and how my transforming this was changing. Meanwhile, my partner, who wasn't interested in the Dharma, continued to want more and more beautiful relics, expanding so that he began to purchase North American Indian artifacts that were worth many thousands of dollars. It was painful and disturbing to watch how his attachment propelled him to spend large amounts of money and invest considerable amounts of time trying to find and purchase artifacts and antiquities. The most painful blow came when our house was robbed and a huge number of those precious objects were stolen. The crowning glory was when it was all taken from him. He experienced deep grief and despair due to his loss. In contrast, even though I lost a number of things in the theft as well, I was so grateful that neither of us was at home during the robbery and that we weren't harmed. Someone evidently had been staking out their place. I have come to understand that I created the causes in a previous life for my things to be stolen and that the karma for that activity ripened. The Dharma also showed me that seeking more and more possessions was like an addict seeking more drugs. There was no satisfaction and a lot of disappointment. It's a true story. So before I go to the finale of today, any comments or questions or sharings?
I have a 14-year-old daughter.
Okay.
And, you know, I work at a nonprofit, so we don't have a lot of money. And my daughter wants the best of everything, the Bourne shoes, the Title IX backpack. And so yesterday, she just, we took a time out. She went to a friend's house. I mean, it was like, well, I want this, I want this, I want this. And I'm just going, ah. So I kind of told her, I don't usually label my daughter and call her name, but I did yesterday. So she stomped out of the house and walked over to my friend's house, who's also a Buddhist. And ironically, I'd been over at my friend's about 45 minutes before my daughter arrived, so she'd have the whole story. And so Gabrielle walked on over, and Veronica just very politely said, "Your daughter's here, and she's fine." So we took about 4 hours away from one another. So it'll be, you know, I grew up in Marin County, so as a kid, I kind of got a teaching early on. I saw people with millions of dollars of crap, judgment there, and we realized they weren't happy, so I kind of learned that you're not happy. But in a way, now I've got a daughter that's like, give me, give me, give me.
Used to live in Marin County in her previous life.
Yes! So trying to have compassion for her as well as, you know, it's parenting a 14-year-old. So, yeah, it's just, but it was hilarious that she pumped on over to my friend who's this one. Buddha's been practicing about 10 years.
She wasn't finding her allies as she had.
Well, no, I think she, you know, compassion.
I mean, what did you, what, so how is your mind with this all? I mean, daughter is going to have to deal with her mind. How's your mind doing with this?
Oh, God. Well, and then I had some stuff. I've had quite a few events lately.
Well, summarize for us the core pith in teaching that you have learned about your mind and how to work with it.
What's the core teaching? First of all, I need help, you know, with my daughter. I mean, I just went through a whole bunch of hard stuff with my son. I thought, oh, yay. You know, I did it. We did probation. We did marijuana. We did all that. He's getting B's in school. So I can breathe, you know, 4 days later that my daughter is coming completely. I mean, she's a straight A student, you know, I don't worry about that kind of stuff, but then she's coming at a different angle. So I said, oh, no, I haven't graduated yet from parenting. You know?
Yeah.
It's I guess it's like we just don't know, you know, the don't know mind. It's like, and then, oh, then she was demanding like a $200 Coke for Christmas. And I just talked to my mom. I said, just give a dollar amount. And then she can babysit and stuff. I mean, I think, I sense there's some, she is under the belief system that, you know, exactly what you're talking about with teaching. The more I have,
the happier
I will be. And, you know, and she has friends with two parents that are making a lot more money. And so then she sees them with all this stuff. And she doesn't think they're necessarily happier than we are. In many ways, she thinks we're a lot happier than some of these other people. So it's kind of a quandary. I really don't quite know. I haven't been sleeping real well, and I'm a bit tired. And then I was like, I need a break from my daughter, and I need to go sit in a peaceful place. Mm-hmm.
Which, as it says in here, you know, the ones that, you know, sometimes space is actually quite a wise thing to do.
Yeah, no, this is, you know, so, big time out right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and that sounds like it was necessary.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, this is where mom's got to be careful that, you know, what I'm hearing is that you really want to stay steady and clear.
Right.
Because
right.
This is an important moment, I think, in her life and in your relationship, for sure.
Well, I mean, I actually have an unbelievable relationship, you know, and
so it'll pass the test.
Yeah.
It'll make it through this.
But this is like, oh boy.
Yeah. So see it for what it is. Two will pass.
Right.
You know. But thanks for sharing, because I can see the quandary in
your face.
I can see the pain in your face.
Yeah. No, it's been a rough couple days.
Yeah. Stay true to your own good heart, your own wisdom. She'll figure it out. Easy way or hard way. Okay. I thought that we would have, as a finale here, and I'll read it quite quickly, is probably one of the greatest teachings in American story writing about the misery of attachment. And it's about a being, a character, who has a huge attachment to peace and solitude, isolation, to be left alone. And when that attachment doesn't get met, the bigger the attachment, the bigger the anger. Remember, that's a clue on how big the attachment's rising, is that you get really upset and pissed off when you don't get what you want. You know the attachment is a big hook. So this is a story of somebody who has a very strong attachment to something and he doesn't get it met and what he does about it. But it comes around to being somewhat of a wisdom teaching for him and for us. And it is, you'll know it. It's quite familiar. And I'll read it and play the characters as best as I can. Every who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot, but the Grinch who lived just north of Whoville did not. The Grinch hated Christmas the whole Christmas season. Now please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. Could be perhaps that his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. Whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve hating the Whos, staring down from his cave with a sour, grinchy frown at the warm-lighted windows below in their town. For he knew every who down in Whoville beneath was busy now hanging a mistletoe wreath. And they're hanging their stockings, he snarled with a sneer, tomorrow's Christmas is practically here. Then he growled with his Grinch fingers nervously drumming, I must find some way to stop Christmas from coming. For tomorrow he knew all the who girls and boys would wake bright and early, they'd rush for their toys. And then, oh, the noise, the noise, oh, the noise, noise, noise. Noise. That's one thing he hated, the noise, noise, noise. Then the who's young and old would sit down to a feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, 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 feast. They would feast on who pudding and rare who roast beast, which was something the Grinch couldn't stand in the least. And then they'd do something he liked least of all. Every who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, would stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'd stand in hand, and the whos would start singing. They'd sing, and they'd sing, and they'd sing, sing, sing. But here they have version in this mind. And the more the Grinch thought of those who Christmas singing, the more the Grinch thought, I must stop this whole thing. Why, for 53 years I put up with it, now I must stop this Christmas from coming, but how? Then he got an idea, an awful idea. A Grinch got an awful idea. I just know what to do, the Grinch laughed at his throat. He made a quick Santa Claus hat and a coat, and he chuckled and clucked, what a great Grinchy trick. With this coat and this hat, I'd look just like St. Nick. All I need is a reindeer, the Grinch looked around. But reindeer were scarce, there was none to be found. Did that stop the old Grinch? No, the Grinch simply said, if I can't find a reindeer, I'll make one instead. So he called his dog Max, then he took some red thread, and he tied a big horn on the top of his head. Then he loaded some bags and some old empty sacks on a ramshackled sleigh, and he hitched up old Max. Then the Grinch said, get up, and the sleigh started down toward the homes where the Whos lay a snooze in their town. All the windows were dark, quiet, snow filled the air. All the Whos were all dreaming sweet dreams without care. When he came to the first little house on the square. This is the stop number one, the old Grinchy Claus hissed, and he climbed to the roof, empty bags in his fist, and he slid down the chimney, a rather tight pinch. But if Santa could do it, then so could the Grinch. He got stuck only once for a moment or two, then he stuck his head out of the fireplace flue, where the little whose stockings all hung in a row. Those stockings, he grinned, are the first things to go. Then he slithered and slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole room, and he took every present. Pop guns and bicycles, roller skates, drums, checkerboards, tricycles, popcorns, and plums. And he stuffed them in bags, then the Grinch very nimbly stuffed all the bags one by one up the chimney. Then he slunk to the icebox, he took the Who's feast, he took the Who pudding, he took the roast beef. He cleaned out that icebox as quick as a flash, while that Grinch even took their last can of Who hash. Then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee, and now, grinned the Grinch, I will stuff up the tree. And the Grinch grabbed the tree and he started to shove when he heard a small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast and he saw a small who, little Cindy Lou who was no more than two. The Grinch had been caught by this tiny who daughter who had gotten out of bed for a cup of cold water. She stared at the Grinch and said, Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why? But you know that old Grinch was so smart and so slick, he thought up a lie and he thought it up quick. Why, my sweet little tot, the fake Santa Claus lied. There's a light on this tree that won't light on one side. So I'm taking it home to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there and I'll bring it back here. And his fib fooled the child. Then he patted her head, he got her a drink, and he sent her to bed. And when Cindy Lou went to bed with her cup, he went to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. Then the last thing he took was the log for their fire. Then he went up the chimney himself, the old liar. On their walls, he left nothing but hooks and some wire, and the one speck of food that he left in the house was a crumb that was even too small for a mouse. Then he did the same thing to the other who houses, leaving crumbs much too small for the other who mouses. It was quarter past dawn, all the who's still abed, all the who's still a snooze when he packed up his sled. Packed it up with their presents, the ribbons, the wrappings, the tags and the tinsel, the trimmings, the trappings. 3,000 feet up the side of Mount Crumpet, he rode with his load to the tip-top to dump it. Poo-poo to the who's, he was grinchingly humming. They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two. Then the who's down in Whoville will cry, boo-hoo. That's the noise, grinned the Grinch, that I simply must hear. So he paused, and the Grinch put his hand to his ear. And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, then it started to grow. But the sound wasn't sad. Why, the sound was sounding merry. It couldn't be so, but it was Mary, very. He stared down at Whoville, the Grinch popped his eyes, then he shook what he saw was a shocking surprise. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing without any presence at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming, it came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. And the Grinch, with his Grinch feet ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling. How could it be so? It came without ribbons, it came without tags, it came without packages, boxes, or bags. And he puzzled 3 hours till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. And this is where he got a Dharma realization. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas perhaps means a little bit more. And what happened then when in Whoville they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day? And the minute his heart didn't feel quite so tight, he whizzed with his load through the bright morning light, and he brought back the toys and the food for the feast, and he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast piece. See, when the attachment doesn't get what it wants, it lies and it steals and it does all sorts of things. So anyway, it is the mind is the source of happiness, and the Grinch is teaching us that. So let's dedicate for all the wise beings of the world who will teach us about attachment, that happiness is derived from our own minds and hearts. And from there, see, this is the beauty about knowing where the source of happiness is that when we understand that it comes from our own minds and hearts, then we can be, we could be Santa Claus forever. We could give and give and give limitlessly once we identify the source of real happiness and fulfillment is our own hearts and minds. And we give it all away. Due to this merit, may we soon obtain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their sufferings. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.